Everyone gets everything he wants. I wanted a mission. And for my sins, they gave me one.
You're listening to Benji's Retrospective of 2010. Catch us at malkinbenji.blogspot.com.
Hello and welcome to a special from Malcolm Benji's Double Bill. I'm Benji, and I'm without Malk today. As my body is currently the latest battleground in the ongoing war between man and the influenza bug, I've decided that rather than just spend the whole day in bed wallowing in my own self-pity, I'm going to record a retrospective of 2010. It's now 1 month since 2010 left us. And I think there's been enough time now. I've had enough time to contemplate and think about my reaction to the world of cinema and film. And for those of you who are interested, maybe a lot of you, maybe not many of you, I thought I'd talk a little bit about the films that I saw in the great year that was 2010. I'm restricting myself to films that were released in 2010. That I saw in 2010. So it's only 2010 films. Anything that I saw for the first time in 2010 from before, I'm not counting. And anything that I've seen in the past month from 2010, I'm not counting either. It's just literally my year in cinema. Okay, so the first film I saw in 2010 was the vampire-based sort of action film, I suppose you'd call it, Daybreakers with Ethan Hawke and Willem Dafoe. Not that bad a film, not particularly good, not a groundbreaking film by any standards, but some really, really nice ideas. What would a world ruled by vampires look like? And I really liked the noir kind of style that was put on there, suits and hats and lots of blacks and whites and very muted colours. Really interesting film. Ethan Hawke was very, very good. Willem Dafoe was very, very good. It's a fairly dumb action film with pretenses of being the next Matrix or something, or you know, that kind of intellectual action film, which it isn't, but it tries to be. But it works of its own accord. It works as a new twist on the old vampire mythos. You know, it's fairly gory. It's certainly not a film for kids. But again, it's not. It doesn't really touch on anything too new, too innovative beyond the initial concept. Worth a watch, I'd say, but you know, you wouldn't want to spend £20 on a DVD. The next film that I saw the year in 2010 was called Exam, a low-budget British horror film set almost exclusively inside a single room. I think the biggest name in the film was Jimmy Mystery. It's basically about eight people who enter a room, and they have one question. And they have to answer that one question, but they're not told what the question is. So they basically spend an hour and a half having to work out through this sort of psychological game of cat and mouse with each other who is going to be able to do it. The only rules are you can't leave the room. If you leave the room, that's it, you're done. And there's one or two other rules, which I can't remember. It was over a year ago now. But it's a very, very interesting film. It ranks up the tension very, very well, and it reveals over the course of the film, through dialogue, that the world they're in is kind of a dystopian future. It's not our world. You know, they reveal things about some kind of mystery disease which has been spreading across the world. And it's they do that. They introduce that concept of a new world in a very interesting way. Also, you think that a room, you know, one room it can't sustain an hour and a half. Well, you know, it does in theatre. An Exam could well be a theatre play. It's very, very well written in terms of the character motivations, the character dialogues, the few twists and turns in there. Again, it's not going to sort of it's not going to change the face of British horror, but it's a very well done little film with some great performances. Which brings us on to another look at the dystopian future. Beg your pardon. With The Road, based on a book by Cormac McCarthy, starring Viggo Mortensen, among others. This is an absolutely superb film, a very, very innovative take on the, well, I say post-apocalyptic. I've discussed this before. It's actually more of an apocalyptic film. It's not about what happens after the world ends. It's what happens while the world is ending. It's a very, very bleak film, very, very well shot, very, very well framed, beautifully acted by Cody Smith-McPhee and Viggo Mortensen as the father and son, unnamed father and son who traverse the wasteland to try and find some kind of redemption, some kind of hope out there. Some fantastic cameos littered throughout the film, some brilliant performances from some of the ensemble cast. Charlize Theron's quite good as the mother. You've got Robert Duvall as this unnamed hermit that they run into. It's a fantastic film. I think there's a very good chance that we'll cover it in more detail in a future podcast. So I don't want to talk too much about it. Suffice to say, it's a very, very good film. Well worth a watch. It's not typical of the post-apocalyptic genre. As I say, it's not about the end of the world. Or not about after the world ends, it's about the end of the world. It's Cormac McCarthy, it's bleak, it's dark. Whatever hope is there, you have to really dig for it. And it's fantastic, and it needs to be seen by more people. So drop what you're doing and go and see it. The next film of a very similar genre, but taking it in a very different way, the next film I saw in 2010 was The Book of Eli with Denzel Washington and the greatest living actor, Gary Oldman. Now, that is kind of what you expect it to be. It's kind of, you know, Mad Max for the 21st century. It's a much more typical take on the post-apocalypse. It's the sort of, you know, civilizations trying to rebuild. It's the central theme is the idea of religion and control. And, you know, the titular Book of Eli is actually the last copy of the Bible. And Gary Oldman's character wants it to control, and Eli wants to keep it to save. You know, it's looking at the two different sides of religion and what they can mean, which is very interesting because, you know, normally you get either pro-religion or anti-religion, and I don't think it's very often, certainly, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think it's very often you get a film which looks at both sides of the religion debate and kind of looks at them equally. It's also, again, very, very well shot, lovely saturated kind of images. It gives a real sandy kind of grainy quality to the film, which really helps you to envision what it looks like in the world. The mise-en-scene is fantastic, you know, the sort of the burnt-out vehicles, the desert land, Southwest America is just phenomenal for that. The fight scenes are great. Denzel Washington really proving his chops as an action guy. You know, he's not doing sort of Matrix style backflips and kung fu, but he's very, very good. He's very believable as a tough quasi martial artist kind of mystic warrior Jedi kind of thing. He's very, very good. Also is the chick from Family Guy, whose name escapes me. She's in Black Swan at the moment. She plays sort of the, not the love interest, but the female lead, love interest by another name. And she, again, is really showing that she's got some acting credentials. She's great in Black Swan, more of which perhaps in a future podcast, but not to be talked about now, not enough time. But she's got a great sort of blockbuster quality to, you know. We've mentioned before, Malk and I, that some people just don't know how to play a blockbuster, and she really does. She's very, very good in that. So again, well worth a look. It's maybe worth looking at Book of Eli and The Road together as two, you know, similar genre but very, very different takes on those similar genres. It's maybe worth doing a double bill about that in the future, but we'll keep you posted. Next up is Edge of Darkness, Mel Gibson's heralded return to acting in a remake of the BBC TV series from the 80s. It's kind of a eco-thriller slash police procedural. Mel Gibson plays a detective. His daughter is killed in front of him, and he has to track down not just the killer, but also the reason why, and it ends up being a big sort of conspiracy, a big corporate conspiracy about sort of eco reasons and oil and stuff like that. It's a very taut thriller. It's nothing near as good as the TV series. The TV series is dated reasonably badly. It's kind of cheesy these days. And while obviously the editing and the pacing of the film is much, much better, and Mel Gibson makes a very, very good film star even these days, you know, even after a lengthy racist, drink-fueled, hiatus from acting, he's still very, very watchable, very, very good as a lead, as a leading man. But the film itself, it's not deep enough. It's not. It doesn't look at these things with enough. Enough depth, enough thought. It kind of just takes a story. It takes an 8-hour story and condenses it into 2 hours, and you've got to lose a lot of stuff in that. So there we have it. If it's worth watching the film, then if you enjoy the film, maybe going on to watch a TV series to get more of the same. The next film on the list is Invictus, Clint Eastwood's film about the early 90s Rugby World Cup, with Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela and Matt Damon as the captain of the South African rugby team, the Springboks. Clint Eastwood can't really make bad films, and it's true enough of this. It's not a bad film. It's a very, very well-made film, very well-crafted, very interestingly written. Again, it's fairly... not dull. Dull's completely the wrong word, but it's not exciting enough for a biopic to really, you know, to really stand out. I have to apologise if you can hear those planes in the background. That's planes. But no, it's not an interesting enough take on the biopic to really stand out. It'll be forgotten, you know, in a few years or a long while as just the Morgan Freeman Nelson Mandela film, the time we all got to see Morgan Freeman do the role he was quote unquote born to play. And he does play the part very, very well. Him and Matt Damon are both stunningly good in the film. It's just the film itself, it's kind of wishy-washy. You know, Nelson Mandela's the kind of guy that you can't really... you can't portray any bad side to him because, you know, do any of us know he had a bad side? Did he even have a bad side? What was his bad side? Obviously, as a younger man, he was influential in quite a lot of death and misery, but then at the same time, he was fighting against apartheid, which is responsible for more death and misery. It's kind of an argument that you don't want to get into here, but maybe they should have touched upon it in the film. You know, to what lengths would he go? That very famously, there's allegations that the All Blacks in the final were given food poisoning, or intentionally is the allegation. But certainly, historical footage shows them being sick on the sidelines during the game. And you know, you think, well, is that worth a mention? You know, is it kind of acceptable to cheat the game if it saves a country? Or would that, you know, it's those intricacies that are missing that I think could have been touched upon in the film that weren't. It's just about the man and his relationship with his country at the time. So, yeah, again, worth a watch. Very, very good acting. Morgan Freeman, stunning as always. Matt Damon, very, very good. I love Matt Damon. I think he's certainly the greatest American actor, in my opinion, at the moment. You know, when you can do stuff like this and you can do sort of comedies and you can do the Bourne films and you're basically making some of the best films in various genres, it's really good, and I think he's definitely someone to keep watching for. I know he's not exactly an up-and-comer anymore, he's an established name, but he's certainly a more interesting actor than a lot of his contemporaries. The next film on the list is Ponyo, which is a Japanese Studio Ghibli film. Again, if I'm pronouncing that wrong, please do let me know, especially Japanese listeners, of which I'm sure there are many. Studio Ghibli film. Hayao Miyazaki is the director and the founder of Studio Ghibli. He's the director of Ponyo, also known as Ponyo on the Cliff, depending on which translation you're listening to. It's basically The Little Mermaid, but retold in modern-day Japan. A young boy meets a sort of strange fish creature, the daughter of a wizard, and she sort of comes onto land and kind of becomes a girl, and they become friends, and then there's a great storm, and it all gets kind of weird. The wonderful thing about Studio Ghibli films, especially the ones that are spearheaded by Hayao Miyazaki, is that they are so perfect for all audiences. You know, they are family films like nothing that Disney or the West does. Their characters are simple and understandable and enjoyable, and yet their themes are deep and all-engrossing and very, very complex, if you want to look for them. And their villains aren't really villainous, and their heroes aren't really heroic. They're kind of real people, but in very extraordinary situations. The finest example widely regarded as the best of the Studio Ghibli films, a film called Spirited Away. It's a film that really brought them to attention in the West, certainly the first of their films that I saw. And it's amazing that you have these wonderful films that have real threat in them, and yet the characters are so likeable. The bad guys in the films are really likeable, and they always kind of, they get redeemed rather than killed. You know, they don't end up being squished. They're not two-dimensional evil like the villains in a lot of Disney films. They're genuinely interesting characters. And Ponyo's no different. You know, the bad guy is kind of Ponyo's father, and he's not really a bad guy. He's kind of a good guy, but doing bad things to us that we can relate to, and then you kind of... It's very, very complicated. It's well worth a watch, because... it's difficult to get across how deeply good these films are. In fact, it's worth getting any Studio Ghibli film out. Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke is another cracker. Porco Rosso is very, very good. Howl's Moving Castle, it's not up there with the classics, but it's very, very, very well made. You know, they do things that Disney and you know, Warner and Fox, they don't dare do. They don't dare do anything new and interesting, and Studio Ghibli do. You know, they're artists in the truest sense of the word. I suppose that, you know, Pixar are the closest equivalent. Pixar films, while still not being quite as inventive as Studio Ghibli, are the closest thing we have in the West. You know, Pixar are consistently churning out very, very, very good films. So yeah, Ponyo, well worth a watch. Okay, the next film on the list is Wolfman. Which is a Joe Johnston film, Joe Johnston of the upcoming Captain America, which comes out this year. I'm going to skirt over this fairly quickly. It's kind of rubbish. It should have been brilliant. You know, you look at Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, you look at Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein, even Stephen Sommers' The Mummy. The modernization, the updates of these classic tales should be brilliant, and Wolfman just isn't. If you really want to see a good werewolf film... either the original Wolfman, if you don't mind a bit of black and white cheese, or American Werewolf in London, which is still regarded as one of the finest werewolf films out there to date. There are others out there, you know, but those are the ones that I would certainly suggest. The Wolfman, it's not great. Benicio del Toro's absolutely fine, but he's not young enough to really pull off the tragedy of the character he's playing. They should have written his character as something else, because Benicio del Toro really does fit the Wolfman character, and if they'd written his character differently, it'd worked a lot better. But they have him as this sort of prodigal son who comes back, and he's too old. Anthony Hopkins is likewise very, very good, as he very often is, but there's not much for him to do apart from sort of do his thing, you know, do his cliched Anthony Hopkins half wistful, kind of half sinister kind of voice going on there. Oh, the full moon is coming tonight, my son. He's done it before 1,000 times, and you know, he deserves better scripts than this. The next film is The Lovely Bones by Peter Jackson. I've not read the book. I think people who have read the book wouldn't like the film, from what I've heard of people who have read the book and then seen the film, because how do you really visually capture something which is utterly relied upon to the imagination of the viewer, of the reader, rather. Heaven, what does heaven look like? You know, especially a heaven which I'm told to believe, I'm led to believe, is very much a kind of left up to the imagination, a very personal heaven. How do you recreate that on a big budget? Well, it's difficult to do, and it's kind of hazy, and it's got some very, very good performances. Mark Wahlberg's not bad, Susan Sarandon's great. Saoirse Ronan, the young girl who plays the main character, she is absolutely superb. I must say, I think she is definitely one to watch. Very held performance, yet while being very organic as well. She's very good on camera. She's very natural, very believable. She manages to sort of play this character like a real person. She's not your usual kid actress. You know, even Haley Joel Osment had a sense that, you know, he had one kind of thing that he could do. But she's very, very, very good. Stanley Tucci is wonderfully sinister as one of the main characters. I've kind of given it away, haven't I, saying that he's sinister. But it's worth a watch. But again, it's not a groundbreaking film. It's not the best film ever made. The next film is far from being one of the best films ever made. It's actually one of the worst films I've ever seen. In fact, I have committed one of my most ardent sins, and I didn't actually finish this film. So the last half may well be stunning, for all I know. Solomon Kane, based on a character created by Robert E. Howard, who created Conan the Barbarian. Solomon Kane's kind of this faux historical Puritan drama about this somber warrior who travels the world fighting evil. And the books themselves are absolutely superb. The books are fantastic, real good pulp adventure. And obviously, there's racist undertones in them because they were written in the 30s in America, which, you know, was a racist time. But if you can get past those, if you can ignore those, what you've got is a real meaty prose with very sort of subtle undertones of magic and character. And when the bizarre does happen, it happens in a very realistic, believable kind of way. You know, it's kind of these lizard men creatures that sort of fly around the sky, but you kind of believe that it's going to happen. And yet in the film, it's all just CGI and kind of Xena Warrior Princess aesthetics. It's directed by the guy that made Death Watch, the World War One trench horror film with Jamie Bell. And he's a reasonable director. You know, he's not a reasonable director because it's the editing's bad and he doesn't really have a sense of tension. He can't really build up the tension, but he designs well. You know, the world looks okay. It's odd. I really, really wanted to like it. I really did. And I tried to go in there with no preconceived ideas about what it was going to be, seeing as I'm a fan of the books. But I suppose I did, and it just failed to live up to it, unfortunately. For those of you who haven't seen Solomon Kane or haven't read the books, the look of Solomon Kane was stolen by Stephen Sommers for Van Helsing. It's that kind of long coat, big hat. Solomon Kane has a sword and pistol, I suppose. Van Helsing has a crossbow and a weird, stupid thing. I'm not going to get into Van Helsing just now, but there are similarities there. And some of the ways that Solomon Kane, the film, fails are the same ways that Van Helsing failed. Not just as a film, but as a human endeavour. Okay, the next film on the list is Exit Through the Gift Shop. Documentary, or is it, by Banksy, about a French sort of amateur documentarian. I'd say that to give him more praise than he deserves. He's really a nutter who basically wanders around with the camera filming all of his life. He met some street artists, some graffiti artists, and went around with them for a while filming things. He always wanted to get Banksy. Banksy sort of said, well, fair enough, come on, make a film. And then the guy failed to make a film and instead became some kind of strange pastiche of the artist world himself. And then Banksy made a film on him. But there's a real sort of, is he or isn't he real? Is there or isn't there a documentary in here? Or is this a fictional film about something else? Is it kind of a postmodern take on its own thing? Or is it quite simply just a documentary about a French nutter with a camera who makes reasonable art that's really based on other people's art? I don't know. All I can say is a very, very interesting film. Very, very entertaining. And for those of you who think that graffiti isn't art, I'm not condoning it. I'm not saying that it's legal or that it should be done. But when you look at the artistic creativity of some of these graffiti artists, there is no doubt it is art. It's absolutely art. So yeah, definitely well worth a watch, this film. Very, very interesting. Very, very funny in places. And get back to me. Is it real? Is it not? What do you think? Okay, next on the list is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Swedish film based on Stieg Larsson's Millennium Trilogy, the first book. The book was originally titled Men Who Hate Women, and that's kind of one of the underlying themes of the story, is this sort of misogynistic, racist Nazi family and all these horrible, horrible characters around. And of course you have Lisbeth Salander, who is, you know, the modern-day feminist heroine. She's not even a feminist heroine, she's just a really, really cool woman. She's the heroine of the story, along with Bloomquist, the editor of Millennium Magazine. And the two of them basically have to solve this big mystery about this this thing. The story's not really that important. It's kind of bog-standard whodunit. But what is really, really interesting is the characterisation of the heroes. Lisbeth Salander is wonderful, and Noomi Rapace, the actress who plays her, is really, really talented. If you've seen interviews with her, she's a really, you know, pleasant, bright, bubbly woman, but she plays this character as a real sullen, determined, headstrong, selfish, willful, courageous kind of creature, this force of nature that wanders through the story, that sort of like bullets for the end, and she's wonderful, she's absolutely fantastic, and you really, really do root for her. You know, it's something that American cinema just doesn't really do anymore, or even ever. You know, it's difficult to try and pinpoint one film where there's such a strong female lead from American filmmakers. Certainly, you've got Thelma and Louise, but that's of course Ridley Scott, a British filmmaker. I'll be interesting to see how the American version goes. I'm not really holding my breath for it, although it is David Fincher, who's, you know, Fight Club, 7, you know, Social Network, he's done brilliant work, so he could really pull it off, but I'm, like I say, I'm not holding my breath. But well worth a watch. The dub on the British DVD, on the Region 2 DVD, is not bad. If, like me, you can't read fast enough to keep up with the action that's going on screen, the dub is absolutely fine. I always find, just as a quick side tangent, that subtitles work better in dramas, and dubbing works better in action films or sci-fi films or horrors. You know, it's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, trying to read that on subtitles, you miss everything you do. So, you know, the dub is important. I think it's important out there for dubbing to be done well, you know, to be done professionally and to get proper actors in to do it. Anyway, on to the next film on the list, which is Green Zone. Again, Matt Damon doing kind of not Born, because that's just being far too simplistic, because the character he plays isn't Born. He's a very realistic soldier kind of character. The filming style is a bit like Born, being Paul Greengrass, who kind of invented that style for the Born films. It's kind of shaky cam, it's very realistic, sort of verite, high fidelity kind of footage, and it's basically about weapons of mass destruction, and the inability to find them. But it doesn't go into the political side of it too much. It dabbles in it, but it's mainly about this guy on a mission trying to clear his friend's name, or trying to clear his helper's name. And it's very, very good, very, very exciting, very, very well put together. Jason Isaacs, hello to Jason Isaacs. Jason Isaacs' moustache is absolutely fantastic, and his performance is even better, as this really arrogant sort of asshole American Green Beret something or other. He's really, really good. The whole cast are fantastic. Brendan Gleeson's brilliant. Well worth a watch. Certainly the equal of Hurt Locker in terms of enjoyability. Maybe the Hurt Locker's, you know, slightly better made, slightly more innovative, I suppose, but they're certainly both up there in terms of the Iraq war dramas. Okay, on to the next film. Shutter Island. Brilliantly designed, wonderful to look at, noirish kind of 1940s style detective mystery, but actually kind of rubbish and boring. I'm not sure about DiCaprio. I'm really not. I want to like him. I really, really do. And in some things, he really impresses me. We'll get to Inception later on. Catch Me If You Can's really good. But he's not what he wants to be. He's not a film star. And he should be, if he's being cast in these kinds of roles. Russell Crowe, much as I dislike his public persona, certainly what you hear about him in interviews and whatnot, he's a phenomenally good leading man. Maybe not as good as that, an actor as he wants to be, but certainly a phenomenally good leading man, a movie star. You watch Gladiator, he is the star of Gladiator. And I just don't think that DiCaprio has that. You know, you watch Titanic and he's not the star of Titanic. You know, Kate Winslet's the better actor and the better character. But even, you know, the captain and Billy Zane and, you know, even these people are better than DiCaprio. He's acted off the screen by Daniel Day-Lewis in Gangs of New York. He doesn't have enough to make himself the real lead and the real hero. And so it's a shame that he's been given this film, which could have been very, very interesting had it had someone with a bit more chutzpah, a bit more charisma. But it doesn't, and yeah, it's a real shame. Mark Ruffalo's fantastic. Ben Kingsley's very good. Sir Ben Kingsley's very good. But it's just not good enough. It's not enough, and the sort of the mystery, the twist, it's not enough of a twist. I call it a twist, you know, not to look for a twist when you watch it if you haven't seen it already. The resolution, the payoff is kind of bunk. It's very difficult to believe. They kind of do two or three at once, and you're left struggling. Well, which one's the most satisfying? Which one do I want to be? And then when it's finally revealed what the actual ending is, you're like, oh, is that it? Okay, fine, whatever, move on. Okay, next film. Perrier's Bounty. not as good as In Bruges, but a very similar style of film, sort of comedy gangster film with some very serious moments, but generally a fairly light tone. It's not as good as In Bruges, but it is certainly up there. It's a very, very watchable film. Certainly a lot better than most modern gangster films. You know, it's well up there. Brendan Gleeson's a phenomenally good villain. Cillian Murphy's superb. The more I see of Cillian Murphy, the more fulfilled my life as a cinema-going audience member is. He's absolutely wonderful. He's able to do so much as the sort of the hero in 28 Days Later, the villain in Batman Begins, the mark in Inception. And in this case, he's a sort of an anti-hero. He's wonderful. He's just a versatile, superb actor. The Wind That Shakes the Barley is a really, really decent film, and he's in that. He's the star of that. Well, he's not the star, but he's the main character in the ensemble. And he's just superb. His qualities are virtually endless as an actor. He's really, really good, and he really helps bring Perrier's Bounty up to a must see for British gangster comedies. The next film on the list, How to Train Your Dragon, is one of the sort of the Shrek busters, one of the non-Pixar animated films. It's from DreamWorks, so it's really more of a Shrek companion to a Shrek buster. But it's kind of in the wake of Shrek, at the end of Shrek, there's a whole new sort of slew of wannabe franchises bursting out. And How to Train Your Dragon's one of the front runners. It's a very, very decent kids film. Again, mentioning before Ponyo, Studio Ghibli, Train Your Dragon's not on that level. It's not up there. Jay Baruchel, the man who voices the main character, he's fine. He's decent enough. And the dragon itself, which you'll see on the DVD cover, Toothless, the black dragon, is one of the great screen dragons. He's really, really cute and very, very believable, and you really root for him. I'm not saying that because he reminds me of my cat Chewy, but he really is a fantastic, non-verbal character like Stitch in Lilo and Stitch or Wall-E. He's a brilliant, brilliant character. Very, very well animated. Very, very well characterized. If I was going to have a dragon, that would definitely be the one that I'd want. On to the next film, Kick-Ass. I hope I'm not going too far across the line to say that Kick-Ass is a film that Malk absolutely adored when it came out. As a big comic book fan and a big film fan, he really, really enjoyed it. I wasn't quite so thrilled with it. I think it's very, very well done. I think it's interesting that it was made without any studio interference whatsoever, and then sold on afterwards to the studios once it was done. It's very interesting that it's uncompromising in that way. And it was written by Jane Goldman, who's the wife of Jonathan Ross, who is also, both of them are also very big into comics, both as fans and as creators. It's interesting. It is interesting. And some of it's really, really good, but it's just not what it was sold as. If that makes sense, it sold itself as this big anti-cliché superhero film about a real guy. What if a real person became a superhero? And I think that's done better in a similar film, which is also on the list, called Defendor. Defendor is another tale of a guy who becomes a superhero. He makes himself a superhero. No superpowers, he's just a vigilante in a mask. And I think even though Kick-Ass is maybe a better film than Defendor, Defendor handles it in a better, more realistic way. It looks at the ramifications in a more mature way. Kick-Ass, it's too comic book to really pull off that take on superheroism. It's too comic book. He ends up in too many comic book situations where he is, comic bookly winning when he really shouldn't. And there's the young girl who, again, is far stronger and tougher and more powerful than a young girl should be. And it's a comic book situation. It works in the comic book, but when you're trying to show what it would be like in real life, it doesn't really work. So it's good, it's worth a watch. If you like comic books and films, this is a good one to watch. But I was a little bit disappointed by it. On to the next one, Clash of the Titans. Dull, boring, very, very cliched. Louis Leterrier clearly just needs to just go and do something else. go and make a music video somewhere. He can't do a film. Much as our first podcast focused on Leterrier's Hulk versus Ang Lee's Hulk, I think Leterrier's Hulk was a fairly decent film, but this just isn't. This just shows that it was the script that did Hulk, not Leterrier. Or even if it was Leterrier, then a bad script can really send him down, and you know, he shouldn't have chosen to do it. Sam Worthington shouldn't be starring in films anymore. We've seen him in enough now to know that he's not all that good. He's fine in Terminator, but you know you want better than fine, surely. That's why you get Christian Bale in to do John Connor. He's fine in Avatar, but again, Avatar, you're looking at the aliens and the special effects. In this, it really is kind of his film. None of the special effects or fight scenes are really inventive at this point. It's all just kind of 300 meets, you know, Xena Warrior Princess meets the original Clash of the Titans. And so you really need to sort of enjoy the main characters, and he's just dull. He's just very, very dull to watch. And the fight scenes are uninteresting, and yeah, it's just not good. Go and watch the old one. The old one's much, much better. Next on the list is Cemetery Junction, Ricky Gervais's film. It's not as funny as I wanted it to be, although it's not meant to be a comedy in the same way that, you know, The Office or Extras or even the Truth About Lying. It's not that funny, it's not that good. It's very honest and it's very interesting as a semi-autobiographical piece from Ricky Gervais, but it's not the sort of magnum opus, it's not the pièce de résistance it was meant to be. So yeah, worth a watch, but maybe when it comes on TV. Next on the list, City of Life and Death, a Chinese film about the invasion of Nanking by the Japanese army at the beginning of World War II. Absolutely superb film, very, very bleak, very, very dark, as it would be being, you know, a very accurate true story. Very, very dangerously insidious kind of film. It kind of gets under your skin and stays with you for days afterwards, and you kind of think about the worst about humanity for days afterwards. Excellently made, very, very harrowing, very, very gripping. It's not the kind of film you want to watch when you're down. It's not Bridget Jones, but it's well, well worth a watch. Certainly a lot more different from most war films. You know, American war films and British war films, we won both wars, so it's a very different tone for us. Whereas when you look at Russian war films, or you look at German war films, or you look at Chinese war films, the tone is very, very different. And this is one of those. It's very, very interesting. Very, very well made. Well worth a watch. On to possibly the most opposite film you could think of, Iron Man 2. A great, big, shiny, explosive blockbuster from those boys over at Marvel. If you liked Iron Man 1, chances are you'll like Iron Man 2, I would imagine. If you didn't like Iron Man 1, same thing. It's basically Iron Man 1, but bigger. Not necessarily better, not necessarily worse. I think that Rhodey's better. I don't miss the old Rhodey. The names escape me at the minute. They shouldn't, because the second one's a phenomenal actor. Like I said, I'm ill. Give me some slack. So, Iron Man 2, yeah, very, very interesting in the same way the first one was. You know, it's kind of Robert Downey Jr. is the main draw rather than the Iron Man suit itself. But then when the Iron Man suit comes out, the five-year-old in you does sort of whoop for joy and scream and yell and go, woo. Yeah, it's kind of bog standard. It's good, but without being great. It's definitely not bad, like Spider-Man 3 or, you know, Blade 3 or, well, most third parts, actually, which doesn't really leave you sort of hankering for Iron Man 3. But it's not bad. There's nothing in it particularly abysmal. And like I say, if you like the recent slew of comic book films, then you'll like it. Next up is Valhalla Rising, which again is a very, very different film. It's a Swedish film, I think. It's in English. But it's about these Vikings, basically, who travel from the north of Scotland across to America. And it's kind of this existential, surrealist voyage, rather than an actual tale of Vikings. It's not an action film, although there is some fairly decent action in it. It's fleeting, and it doesn't sort of overpower the film. It looks phenomenal, and there's a fantastic cast in there. Really, really well designed, well filmed, well shot. But have a cup of coffee with you as well, Or you know, watch it in the morning rather than the evening, because you might fall asleep. Again, not because it's bad, not because it's dull, it's not, but just because it is, it's thoughtful and it's long. And certainly, for my preference, I like watching thoughtful films in the morning and I like watching blockbusters in the evening. Next on the list, Hot Tub Time Machine. Possibly the most tweeted film name since Snakes on a Plane. Hot Tub Time Machine kind of does what it says on the tin. You've got hot tubs, which implies women either topless or in bikinis and drink and debauchery, and Time Machine, which involves time travel. And that's basically what it is. It's a bunch of guys who go back to the 80s to relive their halcyon days, the misadventures they get into. It's kind of a teen gross-out comedy starring middle-aged men and written by Steve Pink. It's kind of like a, it's almost like a an auteur or a serious filmmaker's pastiche of the gross-out comedy genre while still trying to remain faithful to it. There's some very, very interesting bits. There's some very, very funny bits, very, very good bits, but overall it is just a gross-out comedy. And after American Pie, you know, there is really very little doing better than that. So if you like Back to the Future, you like American Pie, you might like Hot Tub Time Machine. Okay, next up is Robin Hood, Ridley Scott's tale of the Magna Carta and the sort of working class version of the land agreement. I forget the name of it. Please someone email in and tell me the name of all the things that I'm missing out. Robin Hood, Russell Crowe as Robin Hood. I think it's been said all before, if you listen to any other film podcast or you've read any film review from any major publication, you've heard it all before. It's not Robin Hood. Russell Crowe's absolutely fine as a, you know, descendant of Maximus, who now is English and or Irish or whatever, and works for Richard the Lionheart, but it's not Robin Hood. They've kind of muddled with the story and saying, oh, well, you know, the historical story is blah, blah, blah. Well, there isn't a historical story. It's not based on any one real man. It's very much a fiction, the Robin Hood tale. And to say, oh, we've gone to historic... No, you don't need to historicalise anything. You know, just tell the Robin Hood story. It's not as good as Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves remains, in my eyes, the definitive Robin Hood. I know, even more than the Errol Flynn version, even more than the Disney version with the fox and a bear. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves was of my time, and I love it. Even though Robin has an American accent, Kevin Costner still plays the part well. Alan Rickman's phenomenal as a Sheriff of Nottingham. Morgan Freeman's great as Azim, who doesn't appear in any other version of Robin Hood. It's not historically accurate, it's not geographically accurate, but my God, is it fun. And that's where Robin Hood, Ridley Scott's Robin Hood, falls down. It doesn't really have fun. What I think he should have done is, rather than make it Robin Hood, he should have made it about the struggles against King John. Left Robin Hood out completely, maybe mention him in passing as a rabble-rouser in Sherwood, I don't know, but just had it about this knight who was fighting for the working man's rights, and had it as the unofficial third in a trilogy of historical action, as started with Gladiator, the middle part being Kingdom of Heaven, and the end being Robin Hood. That would, well, you know, whatever it would have been called, that would have been fine. But making it into Robin Hood diminishes it somewhat, which is a shame, because it could have been really, really good. As always, Ridley Scott's a phenomenal director, and the film itself is wonderful. The action scenes are exciting and interesting. Russell Crowe's, much as I hate to admit it, he's very, very good, apart from the accent, and I don't care what he says. It is Irish, and it is Australian, and it is Kiwi, and it is a bit of, you know, Midlands, but it's not consistent. And you can't just get angry and expect everyone to say, oh, fair enough, yeah, it's consistent. It's not, and he has to face that. He did a very good job trying, and the acting is great, but the accent is not. Okay, on to the next one. Heartless. Low-budget British film starring Jim Sturgis. I'm going to gloss over this fairly briefly. It's well worth a watch if you're into horror. It's kind of low-budget, but it does a lot with that budget. And the cast are fairly solid. Most of the cast are very, very good. I don't want to say much more about it. It maybe deserved a bigger release than it got, but it is a low-budget film. It lives in low-budget areas. Go and watch it if you like horror. It's well worth a watch. On to the next one, Prince of Persia. I'm going to be very brief on this as well. Go play the game. Just go and play the game. It's not the new Pirates of the Caribbean. I don't think Jake Gyllenhaal really is or should be this kind of actor. He's fine, but he's not, you know, he's not that. It's kind of all over the place and not very interesting, and the action's kind of done to death, and Ben Kingsley's kind of dull, just doing the villain that any, you know, Jeremy Irons has done 1,000 times. He's probably done it 1,000 times. It's kind of uninspired and dull. If you like Prince of Persia, go and play the game. The next film on the list is The Killer Inside Me, which is very, very interesting. It's not a film you'd want to watch twice. It's a very unflinching film depicting what has been called misogynistic brutality against women. I'm not sure if it's a misogynistic film. It may well be based on a misogynistic book, but I don't think the film is misogynistic. But it is true that it focuses on the violence towards the women a lot more than it does towards the men. But I don't think it glorifies it, and I don't think it condones it, and I don't think for one second it tries to point out that what's happening is a good thing. So I don't think it is misogynistic. It doesn't romanticise, it doesn't sort of pornographise, or pornographicise, whatever the word is, the violence towards the women. It's not there for enjoyment. Casey Affleck, if you could stop mumbling and enunciate, would be a phenomenal actor. Jessica Alba's fine, Kate Hudson's fine. It's an interesting film, worth watching once, but again, I don't know if it'd be something I'd want to watch again and again. Next on the list, Shrek Forever After. Better than Shrek the Third, not as good as Shrek 1 and 2. If you've seen the first three, you're going to see the fourth one if you're not already. But it doesn't add anything really new to the proceedings. I do quite like the alternative reality thing. I like alternative realities in general when they're done well. And I think it's done as well as a Shrek film could do it. Next up is Predators, which is considered to be the true sequel to Predator. Robert Rodriguez famously scripted it, saying he didn't feel satisfied with any of the Predator films, and he's brought this on. It's really not all that good. It's not as good as Predator 2, certainly. You know, Danny Glover makes a much more believable action hero than most of the characters. Adrian Brody's fine. Adrian Brody's very good. But it's kind of dull and kind of weird, and it's interesting, but it's not the definitive Predator sequel. It's one of those things, if you like Predator and you like Alien vs. Predator, certainly, you'll really like this, but it's not what it should have been. It's not the Aliens to Predator's Alien. It's not, you know, the great sequel that we were waiting for. That's yet to come. Anyway, moving on. Inception is the next on the list. Certainly one of the top three films of the year, if not the top film of the year. I don't think it's quite as clever as you're led to believe, but it is very, very clever, especially for a blockbuster. It's not a genius film, and it's not a cock and bull story, which is a very, very clever film. Inception is kind of a standard, although exceptionally well-crafted, heist movie, but with a very, very interesting twist in that the heist is taking place within the mind, and all the sort of the visual ideas that come with that, the zero gravity, the different landscapes. It's very, very interesting, very, very well made, very, very well performed by a lot of the cast. DiCaprio's fine in it, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's wonderful. You know, the rest of the cast are really, really top-notch. It looks great. Chris Nolan is a phenomenal filmmaker, and I'm really looking forward to everything that he does from now on. You know, once Batman 3's over, that I'm still going to be loving his output. You know, I'm still going to be interested, even though, you know, Batman's kind of what he's known for at the minute. I think his career is going to be the next, you know, Spielberg or the next whatever. I think he really does have enough talent to go all the way. The next film on the list is another in our potential top three. It's Toy Story 3. The best, am I going to say the best? Certainly in the top three best part threes of any trilogy. My own personal bias would put Return of the Jedi in there, even though, you know, any objective criticism would obviously state that it's not in the top three. I love Star Wars, so I have to put it in there. The Return of the Kings possibly in there as well, but Toy Story 3 well deserves a place in there. It's phenomenally told, very, very well acted, very, very well animated. It's really touching, really meaningful. It mixes, you know, the kids' stuff with the adult stuff beautifully well. It's the closest thing that we've got to those great animators like the Studio Ghiblis, or the Nick Parks, you know, the Wallace and Gromits. Pixar is the very sort of paragon of American animation, and Toy Story 3 is one of their best in a very, very long time. You know, Wall-E's great for the first half and kind of, you know, it kind of goes back to just being good for the second half. Up is beautiful for the opening minutes, and then again it kind of becomes a bit, again, still very good, but not reaching up to its promise. In fact, I think since The Incredibles, this is the best of the Pixar films. It's great. It's absolutely fantastic. I think if I could only watch films from one studio, it would probably be Pixar. Seeing as I've already seen Star Wars and Indiana Jones and Blade Runner. Okay. On to the next film on the list is The A-Team, Joe Carnahan's remake of the classic 70s and 80s TV series. All I can really say is that it's okay. It's almost exactly what you'd expect an A-Team movie to be like, which isn't really a very positive sort of way to put it, I suppose. It's dumb, it's fun, it's kind of forgettable, but it's also exciting while you're watching it. Yeah, that's all I can really say. The same can be said for the next one on the list, which is The Karate Kid. It's not really The Karate Kid, because he doesn't do karate, he does kung fu, karate being Japanese, and he's in China. It should be called The Kung Fu Kid, but obviously the brand is The Karate Kid. Jaden Smith is very, very good. Although you'd expect that, he's probably been bred for stardom since he was born. I'm not surprised that he's not actually a clone of Will Smith, who's literally been raised in some kind of studio laboratory somewhere, being taught to, you know, have charisma from an early age. There is that about him. Jackie Chan is phenomenal in the film. He is probably the best thing in it. He doesn't do nearly as much martial arts as he's known for, but his character, the way he acts as Mr. Han, is superb. It shows that beneath all that comedy and beneath that high octane action, there really is a decent actor waiting for more roles like this. So, you know, good script writers, good directors, go out there and cast him as your soulful, sort of slightly older Chinese gentleman. He's really, really good. Sorcerer's Apprentice is the next film on the list. It's a Disney film. It's kind of dull. It's kind of exciting while it's happening, but forgettable once it's done. I think that's another way to put it. It's a bit like The A-Team. It takes the idea of The Sorcerer's Apprentice and kind of stretches it into its own thing. Nick Cage, while looking weirder than usual, acts fairly more normal than usual, and therefore is okay. Alfred Molina is better in other things. He's kind of the enemy of Dudley Do-Right. He's kind of doing his slapstick pantomime villain, which I'm not overly keen on. Jay Baruchel's fine, but you know, in a year where we've got Michael Cera and Andrew Garfield and Andrew, the guy that's from Kick-Ass, you know, he doesn't really stand out. Some of the effects are interesting, but again, it's a forgettable film. It's forgettable. When it comes on Sunday afternoon on Channel 3, watch it, but you know, don't go out and buy it. Don't kill yourself to go and watch it. Next film on the list is a grindhouse spoof comedy called Black Dynamite. Actually, it wasn't released in Britain very widely at all, and it's over 2 years, I think, since it was released in America. It's coming out on DVD fairly soon, and all I can say is it is absolutely fantastic. If you want to know how to do a spoof, don't watch your crazy movies, don't watch your scary movies, your epic movies, your movies. Don't watch them, because you just encouraging them to make more. Go and watch Black Dynamite. It's hilarious. Michael Jai White plays Black Dynamite, the hero, and he is just this badass black belt afroed, you know, blaxploitation god. And he wrote it, or he had a hand in writing it, and he choreographed the fight scenes, and he's brilliant. He's fantastic in it. And the film itself is very, very funny. It kind of stumbles towards the end a little bit with a big fight with Nixon, and it kind of gets a bit political, but again, that's possibly a convention of the genre, so you can't really blame the film for keeping that in. But again, it's inventive, it's funny. There's some really, really interesting bits that mimic the grindhouse, the cheapy sort of exploitation cinema of the 70s. Like there's a bit where a guy gets hit in the face, and he kind of gets hit in the face for real, and he breaks character and he's about to punch the other actor, and the film cuts and it's a new actor playing the guy that's just been hit in the face. And it just tells a story of itself. That one very quick edit just is hilarious because you understand what's happened. And it takes you out of the film, but in a very, very interesting, very, very funny way. So well worth a look. Definitely go and see Black Dynamite. It needs supporting. Next up is the film Salt, which is much, much better than it should have been. It was going to be a Tom Cruise movie, but famously he went and did Night and Day instead, which I haven't seen. Because it didn't look all that interesting. But Salt actually is a very interesting film. It's nothing original, it's nothing new. It's nice to see Angelina Jolie again playing a heroine again. Actually, what I said before about Stieg Larsson, about the girl with the dragon tattoo, Hollywood not doing that so much anymore. Salt is, she is that sort of heroine. She's not an ultra-feminist, uber, you know, man with breasts, like... you know, Lara Croft or, you know, people like that. But she is a very strong leading female. It's interesting to note that it was written originally for a man, which maybe is why that is. Not characteristically, but certainly narratively, why she is such a strong, independent woman who is doing her own thing without meaning to, you know, say that all men are terrible, which is what I find with a lot of feminist heroes. It's very taut, very tense at times. You know, you don't quite know who's on whose side, and it's very effective in the way it does that. It's exciting. If you're a fan of the genre, it's well worth a look. It got kind of bad reviews, but I think in hindsight, I think it didn't deserve those bad reviews. I think it is a very, very decent film. Again, nothing that's going to change the face of cinema, but certainly a worthy addition to the sort of spy thriller genre. Next up is Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, which is a very, very interesting film based on a very, very interesting comic book that kind of merges teen comedy with pop culture, ninjas, computer games, sci-fi, robots, those kinds of things. The comic books, a 6-volume set, are well worth a look. Really, really good comic books that just have... It's almost like a soap opera, but with ninjas. It's brilliant. You know, the characters are well-drawn, well-realised. It's exciting to look at. It's kind of anime, manga... Well, not anime. It's kind of manga design, but not. Brian Lee O'Malley, he's a Canadian-Korean guy, so he's kind of got the Asian influences in the way he draws, and he's kind of got the Western sort of Canadian influences in the way that he writes, very sort of wistful kind of characters. And the film translates those very, very well. I'm not sure Michael Cera was the best choice to play Scott Pilgrim. He's kind of a bit too dorky. Or at least that's what I thought. That's what I thought when I first heard he'd been cast. But actually, to give him his due, he pulls it off very, very well. He's got quite a few fight scenes in there, and he does very, very well. He's kind of tall and thin, but he really sort of... He pulls off the moves, and you believe in the heightened reality of the film. You believe that he's facing off against these people. So yeah, very interesting kind of characterization there. I think that the main lead in the books, the female lead rather, Ramona, is more interesting in the book. She's kind of a bitch in the films. There's not enough time to let her character grow and develop. Mary Elizabeth Winstead, while being very kind of attractive and kind of, you know, you want to kind of see them together. The character itself, the stuff that she has to play with, doesn't give her enough there to make Ramona into an interesting character that you want to see Scott get with. Whereas ironically, Ellen Wong, who plays Knives Chow, actually does, with a character who in the books is very sort of young and you kind of feel sorry for her. In the film, you actually, or I certainly, actually actively wanted Scott Pilgrim to get with her. And in the alternative ending on the DVD, they do, and it's much more satisfying. I think I may be in the minority when I say this, but it is much more satisfying. And it kind of turns the story into a tale of a guy who's kind of searching for this mystic love when really it's right there with him the whole time. And at the end, when he realises that it's Knives that he's meant to be with, it does seem more realistic based on what's gone before. But very, very good film, very, very interesting film, very, very funny film, great music. So well worth a watch. Go and see it. Next up on the list, can I really call this a 2010 film? Well, it was released in the cinemas in 2010. I went to see it in 2010. It's Back to the Future, the original Back to the Future. It's re-released for its 25th anniversary. It's as good now as it always has been. It looks great on the big screen. And while I don't think there'll be any more Back to the Future films, God help us if they ever try and make a remake, go and buy the DVD or the Blu-ray or whatever, watch it again and again. We've got a podcast up on our website about it. It's really, really interesting. It's a classic film. It's brilliantly made. It's very charismatic. Michael J. Fox is a stunning film star. Christopher Lloyd doesn't do enough these days. You know, go and see it. It's great. Also worth a mention, there's a new computer game come out from Telltale Games. If you Google Telltale Back to the Future, you can go and play it on your PC or your iPad or whatever. Next up is a Belgian stop-motion animation called A Town Called Panic, which is based loosely on, or not loosely exactly, based on a short TV series which was created about 10 years ago. If you want to know what kind of thing to expect, the guys that made this film have been making the Cravendale adverts for the past few years with the cyclist, the pirate and the cow. And it's a very similar sort of, you know, small figurines manipulated to act in a very madcap, kinetic, over-the-top kind of way. And if you can imagine that for 90 minutes, well, slightly under 90 minutes, it's exhausting, it's weird, it's kind of... it's like you're remembering something from your childhood that you don't quite remember correctly. But it's good. It's very, very good. If you don't like the Cravendale advert, so you wouldn't like to watch a Cravendale advert for an hour and a half, don't go and watch it, because that's basically all it is. The story is all over the place. There's no dub, so it's in French with... Belgian, I beg your pardon. Whether that's French or Flemish, I'm not sure. With English subtitles. It's very difficult to categorise, but it's well worth a watch if you like that kind of style. If you don't, avoid it like the plague. Okay, next up is The Social Network, which is the tale of the founding of Facebook, based on a book which basically says Mark Zuckerberg is a dick. And he is in the film. Never met the guy, don't know what he's really like. I'm sure he's lovely in real life. Don't suspend my account, please. But in the film, he is a dick. He's a very relatable kind of dick. You don't mind following him, played by Jesse Eisenberg. He's very, very interesting to watch. I'm using the word interesting an awful lot. He's very interesting to watch. But it's a great characterization. It's a great story. Justin Timberlake proving that he's a much, much better actor than he ever was a pop star, playing the founder of Napster. It's great. It's a great film. It's basically, how do you make computer geeks sexy? This is how you do it. It's funny in parts, it's moving in parts, it's very, very witty in parts. It's a corporate it's a corporate machinations film about people using law and regulation to try and outdo each other. And yeah, it's great. It's very, very good. It's a very, very good film with a very, very sort of bittersweet kind of ending. And Andrew Garfield's in it, who's the new Spider-Man, and he is really good. He's really, really good. Okay, next up is Red, based on a comic book, loosely based on a comic book. The comic book's much, much more serious than Red, the film. It's kind of like, what if the A-Team were octogenarians? You've got Morgan Freeman, you've got Helen Mirren, you've got John Malkovich, and you've got Bruce Willis, the sort of old, retired... ex-Secret Service spy, super agent, double agent, you know, killer, assassin people kind of guys, black ops specialists, that kind of thing. And they basically run rings around their younger counterparts when attempted assassinations on them, and they go back for revenge. It's a very, very enjoyable film. Again, it's not going to change the landscape of comic book cinema, but it's well worth a watch, especially the banter between the actors. When the four of them are together, it's really, really funny. Very, very well performed. It's nice to see meaty, good meaty roles like that for people like Helen Mirren, who isn't perhaps known for action cinema, but really has it within her, you know, to do very, very decent characters within blockbusters, not just, you know, quote unquote worthy acting. It's a very enjoyable film. Next up is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1, or HP7A as it's become known. It's a brilliant first half of a film, absolutely fantastic first half of a film. Kind of ends kind of abruptly, and it kind of doesn't, because they kind of give it an ending which seems like an ending, but at the same time, I feel cheated having to pay for what is essentially one story twice. If you could go and see HP7B with your ticket stub and get in for free, I wouldn't have that qualm, but I do. The kids are getting better actors, as they do with each film. They're actually, you know, I can see them having their own careers outside Harry Potter now, possibly for the first time. The cast around them are stunning. The fights are great. The special effects are wonderful. There's very little to be said about Harry Potter that hasn't already been said, or if you've seen a Harry Potter film, to be seen. You know, they're if not getting better at this point, they're at least maintaining a consistent quality at this point. They're well watchable, and I think, you know, for a what will in the end be an 8-film franchise, I think they've bucked the trend for Law of Diminishing Returns, you know, in that the last sort of 3 or 4 are actually among the best. People still say 3 is the best, which I wouldn't argue with, but 4, 5, 6, 7, and hopefully 8 are equally very, very, very good. Okay, next up is Unstoppable, which is a runaway train drama with Denzel Washington and Chris Pine. Chris Pine showing that Star Trek wasn't a fluke. He is a very charismatic leading man. Denzel Washington proving that he's still a very charismatic leading man. He's kind of more realistic in the sense that he's not doing Book of Eli-style machete fights, but he's less realistic in the way that he's still a very, you know, likeable hero when probably real people aren't that charismatic, you know. Not to downplay the charisma of the actual train driver, if you're listening to me. It is, of course, based on a true story. But, you know, you're not Denzel. I'm sorry to say, you're not Denzel. So, yeah, it's a very interesting film. Tony Scott is the master of the fast edit. He's the master of exciting cinema, and this is basically a very simple premise. A train is on the run. Can they stop it? Or a deadly train is on the way, because it's got toxic waste and it's going to crash into an urban area. Can they stop it? That's the film. And the film is basically us watching them try and stop it. Unstoppable, as any physicist will tell you, is utterly wrong, unless they're in a vacuum or no force is exerting on it. But it is, so it is stoppable. It's just, will it stop in time? Although, Can We Stop It In Time is a less good title than Unstoppable, which is why they went for Unstoppable. Yeah, very exciting, well worth a watch, good popcorn cinema. Next up, Voyage of the Dawn Treader. A lot of people have been saying that it's not as good as Prince Caspian. And I'm not sure if I agree. I really like Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I really, really liked it. I think the cast were all fantastic. I really like Simon Pegg as Reaper Cheap. I like the sort of the episodic narrative of it. It's not your typical, you know, classical Hollywood narrative, beginning, middle and end, you know, kind of thing. It has a very fragmented narrative, island to island, lord to lord, bit to bit, and that follows the book. The book is that way, and they kind of try and Hollywood it up with a big fight against a sea serpent at the end. And the ending gets kind of a bit too religious and a bit too metaphysical. But it's still a very, very good film. It's not Harry Potter. It's not as good as Harry Potter. But then, I suppose the books... Oh, I'm going to be very careful here. The books aren't as complicated as Harry Potter, and that doesn't give you as much meat for a film. That's how I'll put it. I'm not saying the books aren't as good. I think, you know, the Narnia books are superb. As a non-Christian, I do. It does the sort of the Christ allegories do bother me a little bit. Less so in Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. You know, there's a lot of religions and a lot of myths that have resurrection in them. But when he says at the end of this, you know, in my land, you know me by another name, it's just like, oh, shut up. You know, I don't need that from my magic talking lions. What I need is, you know, Christ-like, not actually Christ. But yeah, the fights are good. Ben Barnes is good. The guy from Son of Rambo's great. He's really good. He's in a Channel 4 or an E4 sitcom called School of Comedy, which is atrocious. It's one of the most truly dreadful things I've seen on TV. But this film has reminded me that he actually can be good when he's not given dross scripts. So stay in the movies and stay away from your sketch comedies, because they're rubbish. So yeah, well worth a look. Again, if you like fantasy... it's kind of kiddie. It's more kiddie than, you know, Lord of the Rings, but it's still good. I still really enjoy it, and I hope it does well enough to warrant finishing off the films, because the obsessive compulsive in me wants all 7 films finished. Next up is Tron Legacy, which is the infinitely prettier sequel to Tron. And before you sort of think, oh, well, it's a sequel 20-odd years later, it's going to be rubbish, actually, the first film was kind of not rubbish, certainly not rubbish, not bad, but not the masterpiece that we remember it. You know, it looks good, and the story was simple but effective. And this is the same. It looks really good. It actually looks phenomenally good. And the story's fairly impressive. There's a better story there in the background. And if they go on to do a Tron 3, which sort of brings in the idea that sentient life has arisen from this man-made machine, and it kind of paints Flynn as this kind of godlike creature, you know, that's an interesting story to me, looking at religion from that way, looking at sort of bigger themes within sci-fi in that way, interests me. And I think if they do that, then it will forgive a lot of what I don't like about Tron Legacy, which is the fact that it's, here we have this fairly interesting idea about things happening. Oh, look at the light cycle chase! And here's something interesting about the character and fatherhood and family, and is your brother, even though he's not really... Oh, there's another fight in the chase! And it kind of focuses a bit too much on the action cinema. And I know it's meant to be an action film, and I know it's meant to be that, but... You know, in that case, don't try and start looking at these philosophical debates. Don't start looking at these sort of existential realities about, you know, is your brother, or is he your son, or is your father, even though he's a simulacrum of your father. You know, what's going on? If you're going to be interesting, be interesting. If you're going to be exciting. But don't start being interesting and then go, oh, you're getting bored, I'll put something in there. You know, Inception proved to us that we can think and enjoy at the same time. So Tron Legacy, you know, that's what I want to happen with Tron 3, to forgive those downsides to Tron Legacy. Okay, we're on to the last film that I saw. You're probably thinking, thank goodness. The last film that I saw in 2010, which is a film called The Way Back. Peter Weir film about a bunch of Polish and American and Russian prisoners of war who escape from a Siberian gulag and basically march most of the way across Asia before they finally reach British-controlled India. Peter Weir, the guy who directed Truman Show, among many, many others, he's kind of a guy that defies easy categorization, except that his films always have a certain quality, and The Way Back is no exception. It's a very, very, very interesting film. Saoirse Ronan is in this again, and she's phenomenal. She's really, really good. Jim Sturgess from Heartless is in it, and he's very, very good. Colin Farrell's really good. Ed Harris is really good. The rest of the actors are all absolutely fantastic. The tale itself, there's question as to its authenticity. I think at the moment people are fairly concerned it did happen, but they're not quite sure who it happened to. It's based on a book, but it's been widely regarded now that the book was written by a guy who basically told the story about himself, but it wasn't about himself. But regardless, whether it's true or not, it's a very, very harrowing tale, very, very well told, without cliche. It kind of gives you a Brechtian kind of thing at the beginning where it says this is a story about three men who marched into India. So when seven people leave off from the gulag, you're like, okay, well, four of you are toast. And you kind of do think, is it going to be him, is it going to be him, is it going to be him? But it doesn't detract from the film. It depicts the long journey very, very well. It is epic in that sense that it takes ages and it covers thousands of miles, and it goes from snowy tundra to desert to mountains to forests, and you know, it is a real trek. It's like the Lord of the Rings, but in the real world, you know, with real world consequences, like, you know, dehydration and sunstroke and maggots and, you know, that kind of thing. It's really, really interestingly told that way. It perhaps, I don't know, it doesn't stick with you. Even a film like Saving Private Ryan, which is far inferior to The Way Back, sticks with you. It sticks with you because of the opening, because of the closing. It kind of does something. It tells you something about what's going on, even if only through the visuals. And The Way Back, even though the visuals are stunning and it's beautifully shot, the cinematography is wonderful. I don't know. There's something deeper that's missing. I think war films, especially true life war films, need something deeper to really. They need to be saying something about the condition of man or the state of society or, you know, the horror of war or something like that. And I think that was missing in The Way Back. Now, maybe you don't need that. Maybe you just need an interesting tale well told, in which case this ticks all the boxes with a big, fat, red pen. And I'm certainly going to be buying it on DVD and watching it again because it is a beautifully told tale. But I just think it's not the best of its kind of film out there, if that makes sense. Okay, so there we go. That's it. That's my retrospective of 2010. Look out for my retrospective of 2011 in 1 year's time, roughly. We'll be back. Obviously, Mark will be with me back for Mark and Benji's Double Bill Season 2, Episode 5, which will be coming very shortly, hopefully within the next week. And we're also hoping to do a prospective, or a sort of whatever the real word for that is, kind of a look forward to 2012 in cinema at some point in the very near future, before 2011, sorry, before 2011 disappears. Until then, thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.